extension number 11963, rail 9.
Captain Henderson, Reel 9. You were telling me about one of the disadvantages of being, was it president of the mess committee?
Yes. It happened that one night there wasn't anything to drink in the officers' mess. And nobody's fault. It was impossible to get anywhere near where we could buy bottles of whiskey and whatnot. Just one of these things. We'd moved so quickly. And the position was very bad. Well, now, attached to our battalion, there was a padre belonging to one of the Scottish divisions. And he was sitting there, then he suddenly said, well, I'll tell you what, he says, I have a bottle of consecrated port upstairs, if that's any good to you. And, of course, there was an immediate, oh, yes, we'll... And he went up and got that consecrated port and they drank it. And that gave me a feeling, I don't know what, like, I absolutely, personally, inside me, protested about doing a thing like that.
You didn't have any then?
Oh, no, no.
Did you not, you didn't drink it?
No.
Was there a lot of drinking in the regiment, or in the battalion, rather?
Oh, yes, a lot of, oh, yes. I often used to say when I was with the Scottish Rifles, if they didn't have half a bottle of whiskey before breakfast, they're automatically ill. Some of them could get a glass of whiskey before breakfast. They were very heavy drinkers.
Did that affect their efficiency or the way they behaved?
Oh, well, sometimes you could tell that they weren't exactly fit, you know. But I shouldn't say warlike didn't. And yet, on the other hand...
Did they drink like that during periods of active service?
Oh, no. It was only when they were out of the line and they had a mess where they had a sit-down and everything.
So when you were advancing, before the armistice, they were off the booze, were they? Or?
No, I should say they were quite sober in the line.
It was when they were out?
It was when they were out. For instance, I knew a little Gawley who had an MC. I went out one night, and down the street I saw a little crowd in the gutter. And when I looked, here's Gaul, a lieutenant, you know, fraternizing with a few of the boys, and they were making pot pies, things like that. They had drunk so much that they'd lost all sense of proportion. And you had to watch it. You had to sometimes weigh up a fellow when you were talking to him, have a low, have you had too much to drink and this sort of thing. But on the other hand, of course, Scotsmen are noted, more or less, to be whiskey drinkers.
That's what they drank mainly, was it, whiskey?
The whiskey, yes. Yeah.
What about your job as president of the mess committee? What did it involve?
It involved... seeing that, first of all, that things were bought. The officers always cleared the bills when you bought a whiskey, rum, and this sort of thing. I was asked once or twice to get things, you know, were very scarce. But they squared the bills up quite easily. I was responsible for the table, of course, to see that things were done properly. Responsible for quality, and general, the chief bug, of course, was warms, heat. Things were in a bad way all over the country in the First War, but we did manage, and it was not a tiresome job. It was a job that learned me quite a lot, and I'm quite willing to learn it any time, anything. And I felt very happy with the Cameronians, by Jove I did.
No, they were a regular battalion. So
a regular battalion.
What about the question of demobilisation of either the men or you officers?
Well, I should imagine it was a question of the Army Council, what methods they were going to adopt. But definitely the non-professional officers were all on the dissolution list, you know, and I liked the regular army officers, and it gave me an insight to their living. Two of them went off on a holiday once and went to China, and they both came back sick men and never served in the army again. They caught something. But the colonel was a regular soldier. He was an heir to a baronetcy, this sort of thing. It was rather nice. I enjoyed being in the Cameroonians. And, of course, we had two bands. We had a pipe band and a military band. We had a nice drum major. And life was rather good. And, of course, you had something in...
Whereabouts were you in France? I mean, or Belgium? Where were you based after the armistice?
Well, we came back to somewhere near... And we sorted ourselves out. We stayed there until things were sorted out. But we came right back to the coast near Amiens. Gradually we all melted, and they offered, this is rather a mute point, they offered anybody who'd been commissioned during the war the rank of corporal if they would remain with the battalion.
Corporal?
Yes. Now you might not believe that, but make inquiries. And if I'd wanted to stay in the army, I would have been offered a corporal rank.
You'd have lost your commission?
Lost my commission, yes. That wasn't quite fair, you know. At least I thought it wasn't quite fair. I could have got off on a career, really, if it had been otherwise.
You might have stayed in the army then if you'd been...
Yes, it was a possibility. I'd entered a world which I knew nothing about, and I had done pretty well in it, both with the Northumberland Fusiliers and the Cameroonians. But no, that gave me an angry sort of feeling, that to remain with the Cameroonians you'd be given a corporal rank.
So how were you demobilised and when?
And I was demobilised in France, of course, and we came home, and we came to Catholic Bridge, as a matter of fact, to be demobilised, and I simply went home.
And when was that?
When was that? That was in 1919.
Do you know when, roughly?
What's that?
When about, roughly? What month?
I should think it was July. And I came back to take up my offer by the railway company to carry on my apprenticeship as an accountant and settled in. But I may say that the Cameroonians have looked after me since then and still do, offering all sorts of things. My wife and I have gone down for years to London, having lunch and reunions, you know. Most of their activities, of course, were in Glasgow or Edinburgh. And we've enjoyed quite a lot of outings.
So you served with them at the very end of the war, and then for about a year in all, then?
Yes.
Now... What did jumping over the interwar period, what happened in the Second World War? How were you used in the Second World War?
Well, now, tell you, start from the beginning, there was a threat of war. And some of the people who were the War Office want best are railroad people. Although they had their own railways down in the South Country, and I knew about them and had taken an interest and visited them very often, the general manager sent for me and said, if a war breaks out, Henderson, you've had a commission in the army. Would you be prepared to come back again? And I said, right, got a nice lunch and departed. So it was easy. He had gathered his troops beforehand, and it was just a matter of him taking over. And I went down to the Royal Engineers Railway Operating Department immediately and became a second lieutenant again, of course, then a lieutenant, then a captain. And I served as a staff officer transport with the War Office the whole of the war.
And what could you just give us a quick resume of what exactly your job was and how you carried it on out?
My job was to seek to visit places where they thought something should be done about something. I'll give you an instance. When I finally was picked to go out to France in the Second World War, it was as a member of a group of qualified people, dock workers or ship captains, etc. I went out as a railway officer only to open out Antwerp after we got the Germans back. Mainly after the water was declared safe around Antwerp. I never had a billet from the army in the Second War. I had to find my own on the continent or in this country. It was rather good. But when we went out to Antwerp, we went out as a body of people capable, and I was to be the railway executive officer in Antwerp.
But what exactly did you do? Do you see what I mean? You told me what your title was, but you haven't told me what you did.
Oh, well, I was the railway officer, and that meant cooperating with the railway people on the continent, like at Mons, where there's a big office, you know, and arranging trains and generally conveying to the land people what was coming in by sea and seeing that was all properly documented and this sort of thing.
And that's what you'd been doing in England as well?
Oh, yes, it was my... I had learned to do it properly. There's a special book issued to all railway operating officers, what should be done and how it should be done.
Do you remember many of the details of it for us? I know it's a long time ago.
I was detailed for this job. It was about 6 months before the war ended. But I'd worked most of the war on the railways, you know. A sample of how I got a job in the Second World War. I was to be the railway officer when they opened out Antwerp. But one day there was a staff officer came to me and said, "Oh, Henderson, would you like a little job?" Because all I was doing was going up to my office, which looked into the animals at Antwerp, you know, the zoo. That's what I could see out of my window. I could see the zoo every day. And I'd gone there, and it was a waste of time. We were doing nothing. And we were billeted where all the diamond people used to live, in a block of modern flats, you know. And the Germans had skipped them all with heat and everything. And they were just cold recipients to live in. I says, "Yes, I'll take on anything. I would like something to do, to be active." He says, "Well, we've just had important messages from the front that the roads are being devastated by the Germans, and we want somebody to organize loads of stones from Belgium. And we've picked on you." Could you immediately go on and get on with it? And I said, well, what had you in mind? He says, they thought Belgium was the best place. So I knew quite a lot about Belgium by that time. And I went to Lessines, where they had quarries, and they had quarries dotted about the country, you know. I had a word with them. Yes, they very kindly gave me the pencil that the German officer used in the same office in which I was sitting. And I started from there and organized 5 loads a day of stone, certain sizes, small, large, tarmac, this sort of thing. And I took up residence with a lady and her husband in Lessines, traveled all over the place, visiting various places. And I had that until the war ended. We were piling the stuff up, it was purely a railway job. The station master gave me an office in his station at Lessines, I enjoyed it very much. And then the war finished, and we saw the bloodiness of the war when it finished.
In what way?
Well, I'll give you an instance. I was having a cup of tea in my billet one afternoon after the war, and there was a knock, and the lady went, and she said, there's a sergeant to see you. So I went and saw the sergeant. I said, hello. He says, if I were you, I'd put a revolver on and come down. So I said, righto. He waited for me. And I says, what's the idea? He says, oh, there's a crowd of about 4,000 or 5,000 gathered outside the station. He says, they know there's a train coming with traitors on. Oh, well, before I could get onto the station, I had a fella hanging up home. It was a dastardly business after the war. My God, they didn't like traitors. Shortly before the war finished, we decided to evacuate a town, and because we were going to use heavy artillery. And I always remember going to the station where these people were coming out. And in the process of clearing a town, it gave everybody the opportunity of seeing the traitors that they were looking for. And by God, their heads, lad, were in a row before you could see a Jack Robinson. It was a ghastly business dealing with traitors. Yeah, yes, made me afraid sometimes for the human race, but there you are. I had to cut them down.
They were hung then?
Oh, hung up, yes, without any question of. But I always bore in mind, of course, that Belgium and Holland still had their own people of every class, and Belgium still had an army. And I always used to make myself known to the colonel, the nearest colonel, and have a word with him and say, well, now, it's your people who are dealing, who are doing this, not me. I haven't any knowledge of who's traitors. And I says, the killing's going on, so I more or less shifted the responsibility.
Left him to sort it out.
Let him to sort it out, yes. And then everything became quiet. But they remembered quite a lot. They remembered for years afterwards who the traitors were. Yes.
And when were you demobilised again?
When did the war finish?
In Europe, May 45.
Well, I would be there for 6 months after that. Cleaning up, you know, and doing this, that and the other. There was a question of leaving railway engines there. We'd left some in the First War. Well, I went the Second War, I could still see locomotives which had been left by the army and given to work people, you know. And we did all sorts of things. I acted as a buffer between the civil population and the army. It was a cry because some of them had never visited their aunties or their grandmas the whole of the war, and I had a car. And of course, having a car was a deadly thing to have after the war finished. Oh, sir, captain, you know, buying their hats and all sorts of things. God bless them, it was rather sad.
Now, during your period, you'd been the rail officer. Had you been working as a link between the army and the civilian railway people?
Oh, yes.
The French,
yes.
Or the Belgians?
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
Have they been efficient, the French or Belgian railway service that you worked with?
I'll give you an example. It was decided that we would send the Russians back, who were in Belgium and France and Holland, to Russia. That they would go from station outside of Brussels and catch a ship, which would be arranged. And we had meetings about it. Things proceeded. And I was told eventually that all the Russians that had to go back on our consignment were in a monastery outside of Brussels. Would I go and see the person in charge of them so as we could arrange how many to do and this sort of thing? Which I did. And the time came and the RAF promised to take them from the monastery to the train at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, the first ruddy thing that happened was that the RAF forgot or made a mess of the time. It was always a sad thing to remember that the time on the continent wasn't the same as the English time, you know. Oh, my. I got the train in, and it wasn't a train as we know it, it was horse boxes. 8 horses or 40 men, you know. Well, they pulled it into a siding which was near an RA dump. So, all right, I saw the Russians in charge, talked to them, and they said they would load the train up. And it was supposed to leave at 9:30 or something like that. Well, when just before 9 o'clock, there's a colonel came to me. He says, "Who's the bloody people in charge here?" I says, "Well, I am, sir." I says, "Can I help you?" He says, "Yes, you can get this bloody train cleared." He says, "And damn sharp about it." Well, what the people who got onto the train had done was to see his RE dump with all sorts of things in for building, you know, and put in them to sit on or lie down and all this sort of thing, you see. So I got hold of them and I said, "They'll have to go back." And by that time, there was a Russian colonel came, and he was a great big 7-foot fella, you know, and I was looking up at him. I told him what had happened, and the train couldn't go, and the train wouldn't go until I said so. Made that quite plain, that was the military order. And eventually they got them put back into the yard, and our colonel was quite satisfied. Then the man leading the party came to say that the young people of the party had gone away drinking in pubs. So they had to be brought out. That was another hour or two's delay, you see. Right, we got things started up again. And then I gave the off. I says, "Yes, you can go now. Everything's arranged for meals, etc. All done behind the scenes, you see." And the driver came running out to me. He says, "No go, no go, no go." I says, "What the hell's the matter now?" He says, "I can't see the guard's green flag." Because people on the train, in their excitement and joy of going back to Russia, had decided to decorate the train with tree trunks and all sorts of things like that. My God, 6 o'clock arrived that night before we got the train off. And eventually Henderson breathed and had a cup of tea. But there was all this excitement, all this joy de vivre if, when the war was over. I just thought I'd give you an instance of a train being nearly 12 hours late. You see.
And how would you sort out things like the points? Or the? Would you be in charge of sorting all that out? I mean, because trains can't just go 12 hours late, can they? It's not a clear track run through.
Oh, no. What I had to do was to get a path. All trains, no matter where they're running, have a path laid down to get there. Well, what happened is I had to ring up the Mons people and tell them our train couldn't start. I would not a path for the train, a new path for the train. And I had to wait until they gave me a new path before I could say to the Russian colonel, you can go.
That explains it perfectly.
Oh, yes. And the Mons people still write me a letter sometimes saying what a happy time they had when I was there. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.